Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Cage podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about a television show that we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the first season of Batwoman. Like we're doing with the rest of these CW shows this season, we're going to record right now the first part of the season, which is, I think, about 8, maybe 9 episodes in. Everything before Crisis, we'll come back, we'll watch that hour of Crisis, we'll record on that, and then afterwards we'll record on the rest of the season when that's done. We'll probably string the 5 parts of the Crisis crossover into its own episode, get that out a little earlier, because I think it'll be a big deal. Or maybe 2 episodes if it's really long. I don't know. Actually, that would be fun. If it's long enough, we may get one out before the other part comes out. Anyways, this is the first part of the first season of Batwoman.
It's always good to start this episode with we feel free to spoil.
Spoilers on this show, on other CW shows, on other Batman-related shows, on the Batwoman comic, on anything that comes to mind during these discussions.
We just like to cover our bases.
Yes. No, good reminder. Good reminder. Because I tend not to do spoilers on the Weekly Comic Spotlight, but with the TV shows, I think it's a little different, partially because not only is there stuff in this particular batch of episodes we're going to talk about, but how it relates to the other shows, we got to talk about that. People may not be up on that. But also there's stuff that happened in these episodes that harken back to the Batwoman comics that I do want to kind of pull in and stuff as it comes up.
Well, starting just with the very first episode, which is rare for me. Usually I'm horrible about that. But I have problem placing when we were in Arrowverse.
That's actually one of the complaints I've got about this season so far is we had been introduced to the Batwoman character last season as part of the Elseworlds crossover. It was pretty much implied it was on the same Earth as Ollie and Barry and Flash and Arrow and stuff, but it was just kind of convoluted and stuff that it's like, did they remember which Earth they're on? Because I've gotten a little lost. And at some point, we need to go back through all the crossovers they've done, and particularly that one, and see if they were clearer than I had realized.
Well, and in the Elseworlds one, they went to Arkham.
They went to Arkham. There was an escape. But her costuming and stuff like that, it took a good couple of episodes, like 6 or something, to get to about that point.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to place when the crossover happened versus the initial episodes versus when Crisis.
Well, there seemed to be just kind of a line of dialogue that magic wanded Elseworlds. Like, magic wand, there was the Arkham escape that happened in Elseworlds in the past few days.
Yeah, like it fits between, like, around episode 6-ish.
Yeah.
But it was a little oblique and a little, frankly, a little confusing. And I don't know, maybe there's a website or a Wikipedia article or something that clarifies all of that.
Well, and because of my confusion at the very beginning of the season, as we were meeting some of the foes, I was trying to figure out, are these people we saw in Arkham that escaped in Elseworlds? That was part of my disorientation.
What I would have appreciated if at the point when that first crossover happened, first for her, if they had just done a sequence of almost like a clip, you know, rapid fire montage or whatever, for us to know, oh, this is where, you know, if we had gotten her going to the rooftop, meeting, you know, Barry and Ollie as the inverted characters or, you know, flipped characters and stuff, got a couple of just the highlights to remind us, oh yeah, that's what happened from her perspective, and then kind of move on. That would have really helped because it's a year ago that crossover happened.
Well, and in Elseworld, I don't remember any reference to the crows, for instance.
No, I don't think there was any. I don't think they had the show figured out at that point.
Yeah, because she didn't have the assistant, Lucius Fox. So she was very much a one-woman show in Elseworlds.
Well, and there wasn't even a reference of Lucius being out of town, which would have explained that. It, again, not knowing, it was hard to piece in where it fit in.
Yeah.
Lucius, I think, works.
Yes.
I think they've made a reference to his father being not around, like dead. Yes.
They talked about his father being shot, about the officer who investigated the case, and getting justice for them, which made a big difference.
But it sounded like a killing, not just a wounding.
Yeah, as I recall.
The whole dynamic with the Kane family they've set up here is similar-ish, but a bit different from the comics. Her father plays an analogous role in the two.
Okay.
But there is no Crow security or whatever. Obviously, Batman's still around in the comics. Not so much here. The half-sister.
I love the stepsister.
Stepsister, sorry.
Mary Hamilton. Mary,
yeah. New, I think, for the show.
I love her.
She fills a similar role to like a cousin the comic character had of Bat Kane, who became kind of Batwoman's Robin equivalent of, originally it was Batgirl, but then that was before the Barbara Gordon Batgirl. And then after that, it was Flamebird, which is a callback to the Kryptonian kind of Robin equivalent. And I don't think they're going to take Mary in that direction, but you never know. And the stepmother, I don't recall from the comics.
Catherine Hamilton annoyed me from the moment we first met her.
Yeah.
She's an arms designer / dealer, which may be part of it. I don't tend to gravitate towards the arms dealers.
The problem I have with her introduction is they're going to this gala event or whatever. We got her and we've got Mary. And at this point, I'm like, who are these two? And I'm just being introduced to them. They're cutting around a lot. It was hard for me to differentiate the two.
Yeah. Well, and for most of the 8 episodes, it was really hard to tell if Mary Hamilton was a stepsister or a half-sister. And to most people, they're saying, or thinking, I would think, why does that matter? But it's, is Dad a common parent or not?
Well,
is Beth a common sibling or not?
I think that does make a difference in the relationship between Mary and Kate.
Yeah.
Of, is this somebody that came as part of Dad getting remarried? Or was she there when Mary was born and along for the whole ride?
Exactly.
And I'm still unclear on that.
Yeah. Well, at one point, they seemed to say stepsister, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I need an episode where they do a little flashing back to when Catherine and Dad first met.
They need to, yes.
Because they, for me, they haven't even really clarified the age difference between Mary and Kate.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's part of the issue there. I'm still a little unclear on the difference between Kate and Bruce.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how old they think Bruce is in this world.
Well, Bruce was an adult Batman when Kate was, what, 12? We know that much.
We're going to get at least one Batman in crisis. I don't know if it's the Batman of this world or another.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious.
Mm-hmm.
And the family dynamic is pretty interesting. The bit with introducing the girlfriend from the military academy who's now working for Dad at the Crows. Alice is such a major player here.
Well, going back to the girlfriend, that's one of the major honesty threats. Are you honest in your life? Are you honest with the people you love? And they're really hitting the theme of honesty and...
honesty and loyalty and yes. How the two can work at cross purposes.
Yeah.
They're doing some good stuff, and I think the actress who's playing Sophie is doing a great job.
She really is, and she plays the being kind of caught in the corner between people.
Trying to follow the rules and do right when there is no right to be done.
Yeah, yeah. And then with Alice, she's creating these situations where, again, with the loyalty and the love, you're torn between family and what you know is morally right.
Well, with Alice, it's very much a sometimes you play the cards you're dealt and it sucks.
Yeah.
But that put you down a path that almost anybody could have gone down. And mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to default them to a degree as you should.
Well, they've done a good job of walking this tightrope where Alice isn't totally lost. She hasn't fallen totally to the side of the devil. Not to say she's on the side of the angels.
I see her as in a similar role to the Tobias Whale character in Black Lightning. I think she's always going to be around in some way, shape, or form, even if she is off screen for a while.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Sorry, I thought you were meaning on the moral compass.
No. I mean in the narrative role. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I see that.
Because she's Kate's twin sister. She's the main adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be hard for somebody else, even if they're a major threat to Gotham, to fill the same level of role personally for Batwoman or for, you know, most of the other characters.
Well, frankly, she opens a lot of interesting possibilities in terms of if she's in Arkham, you can go visit her in Arkham, either in the form of Kate going to visit her, yes, in Arkham, or the camera going and story-wise visiting her, well, in Arkham.
And if she's in Arkham, does that put her out of play, or does it just put her in play in a different way?
Exactly. Yeah. But no, see, for me, she's homicidal. She's not a, strictly speaking, good person. And yet, she disables a weapon that would kill Kate.
She's not even loosely speaking a good person.
But she's not, strictly speaking, a purely bad person. And yes, that's that tightrope that it's fascinating to watch how they're writing her on.
Well, and that's where I see parallels to the Tobias Whale character. He's definitely not a good person, but there are certain things he does that is in his enlightened self-interest. And if that means he helps other people, it's, you know what I mean? There's similarities in terms of both, I think, are incredibly what's in it for me. How can I get what I want? If I got to help you for a little bit, great. But the minute I'm done with you, you know.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't seeing Alice's caring for family as enlightened self-interest. I can see where you're coming from on that. But I guess I was seeing she still has a spark of love or something in her.
Yeah, I think there's similar attributes that come out differently between the two characters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a personal relationship between that adversary and the hero in, mm-hmm, the two shows. And the Wonderland Gang is fun, that being, you know, an Alice thing, whereas at times, I think that's definitely from the comics and stuff, at times there's an aspect of kind of the Wonderland Gang-ish sort of a thing with the Mad Hatter,
mm,
for similar reasons, and he usually has, at times, you know, been abducting people named Alice or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Similar theme, cliche, gimmick, whatever you want to call it. And I'd like to see some of those sorts of characters pulled in, even if it's just like Tweedledee, Tweedledum, the big, you know, thugs or whatever kind of a thing from the comics. Bring them in. Mm-hmm. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
The fact that we have yet to see really any other Batman villain in this show surprises me.
Interesting. I mean, they referenced...
They've mentioned the Joker, they've mentioned the Riddler.
Yeah.
But there's so many... Magpie, actually, they brought in. That was a Batman villain.
Okay.
But not exactly what I would consider in the known part of the Rogues Gallery.
Yeah.
So they've got some stuff there. Mouse, who they've brought in as kind of, I don't want to say the assistant or partner of Alice, doing a great job with the character. I don't like the character.
I don't like the character, but I find it fascinating the way they've juxtaposed the family she ended up in with the family she was born into.
The episode where we get her side of what happened with the crash and all that, I thought was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it established Mouse being this master, you know, voice mimicker.
Mm-hmm.
But then adding to it the ability to have Mission Impossible-esque masks.
Yeah, they came from Daddy Doctor person.
Yeah, that whole bit. There are other ways you could have done a chameleon-ish character. And we got to one episode, I think it was the 7th or something, where at the end they reveal the person we thought was Commander Kane the whole time was Mouse. And I'm like, wait, when did this happen? I got to rethink stuff.
Yeah.
And...
Well, and we had to discuss, okay, at what point do we last know we saw Commander Kane in the city?
The part that worries me is at some point we're going to see a... previously on clip,
mm-hmm,
that's got Mouse and they're going to be doing it as if it was Commander Kane.
Yes. And I actually carefully watched the next episode to see if they did that to us.
I think the mistake they're going to make is going to be, you know, half a season down the line.
Yeah.
So I think we're stuck with some of those characters for a while. And again, what they're doing is really, other than Arrow, the closest we've gotten to a live action Batman show on primetime TV since Birds of Prey.
Well, for me, they're doing a lot of interesting stuff because they've got Kate Kane in this situation where she has a sister figure, a stepsister, offering a healthy sister relationship. And yet because it's a stepsister, because they haven't seen much of each other in 5 years, et cetera, she's not leaning into it. Whereas she has the twin sister who offers absolutely nothing in the way of a healthy sister relationship.
Well, and at the end of the episodes leading into Crisis, they spin both of those, and Kate is just flipped. She's done with Alice. She wants to support Mary. Mary wants nothing to do with her and stuff. Mm-hmm. I expect within two or three episodes after Crisis, that rift will have healed. Not entirely, but fences will be mended and they'll be going forward on that.
Well, and they've done a lot of basically look beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Mary being the prime example of she portrays herself as the fashion-obsessed
socialite.
Media.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you scratch the surface, you discover she is so much more.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think they backpedaled a little from the first episode on how people would arrive at these gala events in armored cars and stuff like that because Gotham is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And I haven't gotten the sense of really that kind of crime rate. And even so, it never feels to be super villain type crime.
But part of it is in terms of expense and effects. They seem to have gone all out in the first episode. I mean, we had the pillars coming up out of the street to block roads and the feeling of a gated entry.
Absolutely, I think there's a cost aspect, but if it had always seemed like at Crow Security that there were people all over the place and it was all hands on deck all the time, coordinating calls, all of this stuff, another bank robbery, another this.
Yeah.
We've almost gotten it under control. If we could just push a little harder kind of a thing.
We seem to have fewer and fewer visible people at Crow Security each time we go. Now, sometimes we're there at midnight.
Some of that, but even when we're there and there are people, they're working, but it's just like an office building.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like a first responder situation.
That's what I was about to say. We don't have the sense of a lot of people rushing about to deal with emergencies. We have the feeling of a bunch of people hanging out at their cubicles, taking care of paperwork.
Even if that's just the call center or something, it should be ringing off the hook.
Yeah.
There should be people very glued and intently and having things happening in the background, even if they're quiet and whatnot, give the sense that the city is metaphorically on fire.
Yeah.
And that's...
Well, and Supergirl did a great job in early seasons with that bank of monitors in Cat Grant's office, where she had every news station on.
Things were happening in the world and you could see bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
Here, not only in that main room is it sedate, every time we go out into the hallway, it's empty.
Yeah. Well, and we have a bank of monitors, but they all look like black and white security footage in which nothing's happening.
Or a most wanted thing that, hey, if you happen to bump across this person.
Yeah.
So I think there's some subtle things they could do there that could make it feel like there's more going on in the city than it currently feels like.
Okay, so little things I've noticed that maybe don't faze you at all coming from the comic books, but it took me probably 4 or 5 episodes to get to where the Crow Security logo was distinctly different from the Wayne Industries and the Batman, and distinctly different from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
For me, that wasn't a problem. It was a very militaristic thing for Crow Security. And it's funny because the building they're in, it's like I can't place the room we tend to see as to, is it the top floor, bottom floor, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's kind of weird. It doesn't make sense for it to be up at the top, even though that's where it feels like it ought to be. And there's aspects of the Wayne Enterprises stuff where it's in really good shape and enough traffic for something that's kind of boarded up and blocked off.
Well, it's boarded up and falling apart on the ground floor, but we seem to have fixed up the penthouse. And then we go into the, quote, safe room to get down to the Batcave.
But even when the photo group's coming in or whatever to do the pearls or whatever, it's like, I can see where it's not a, hey, people are coming in, it's closed, but boarded up.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. There's some stuff like that where I think using Chicago as a stand-in is working well. The visuals and stuff make sense.
But it's very different than what I feel the TV show Gotham was showing for Gotham.
Absolutely. They went more for a New York style and went heavy on kind of the gargoyles and the
sculptures at the top of the building in general.
Yeah.
The very character, making the city a character, really.
Yeah. Gotham here is just another city.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the visual distinctiveness that the Gotham show Gotham had. And it doesn't have the foreboding sense of violence or whatever that they're kind of thinking it does.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is they're just finding their way. And I think they overstepped a little on the first episode and in a way that they had to backpedal.
Yeah.
And they're not explicitly backpedaling. It's just kind of happened.
Yeah. Well, like you said, it's the subtle cues that you see, but they aren't written in the script.
Well, most shows during that first half season, they're finding their way. They're figuring out where they're going and what really makes sense. We saw this in, as you know, Next Generation for Star Trek and many, many, many other shows.
Well, Star Trek Next Gen being a great example with Worf's makeup.
Worf's makeup, film versus video production values.
Mm-hmm.
Deanna Troi's wardrobe, Picard's mannerisms to some degree, and how he fits in with the crew. I mean, a lot of things. And again, it's just, I think every TV show starts with the one they have planned, the one they film, the one we see, the one they think they're making, and the one we wind up with.
Yeah.
And there's very distinct phases, and you could see they thought they were making this show, or we were watching this show for this reason, and they, I don't want to say course corrected, but almost course uncorrected at times. This is one of those shows where I think where we're going to be at a season from now will be very subtly different in many respects, explicitly different probably in a few, but much stronger. And I think it came out of the gate reasonably strong.
Well, for me, this feels like I want to sum it up as a Next Generation team show.
I think that really came out in the episode where we got Tuxedo One, who is Julia Pennyworth, Alfred's daughter. No mention of if Alfred's alive or not. Implication was he was.
Yeah.
But you've got the daughter of Alfred, the daughter of Lucius Fox, and
son of Lucius.
Sorry, yeah. Lucius. And the cousin, but the stand-in for a daughter of Batman kind of a thing. So it very much felt like a Batman 2.0 or Batman the Next Generation.
Yeah.
And I thought the Julia Pennyworth character was great.
Mm-hmm.
Filled a very similar void or role as that character in the comics, who has both worked for Batman and for Batwoman, although often is just nowhere to be found. And definitely want to see that character come back. Expect to see that character come back.
Well, it was interesting because Luke, Kate, the Pennyworth girl,
Julia,
and Mary Hamilton made a compelling young team.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause
I expect Mary to get pulled into the cave scenes probably within, if not this season, next.
I mean, Kate's gone to her to get patched up.
Yeah.
She's taken people to her to get patched up. It's been a fascinating dynamic to watch, and it just keeps kind of reeking of the when will you tell her, how will you tell her, and this will be a new level of trust between them.
To me, it's following patterns established by the other CW shows.
Agreed.
You know, when does Felicity get pulled into the fold?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very similar arc in high level with Mary. I think there's also an aspect of, Kate got offended at a restaurant that said Batwoman could eat there any time, that when she went there as Kate and was visibly gay, she was basically asked to leave.
Yeah.
She buys the place across the street to set it up as a gay bar just to annoy the guy.
Yeah.
Gosh, where have we seen somebody opening up a bar? Wait, Arrow did that.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to have a cave underneath this or something? You know. So, again, there's again, they've done, they're on the eighth season of Arrow, the sixth of Flash, the fifth of Supergirl, fifth of Flash, whatever.
Well, but
they've done about 15 seasons of these shows, it feels like, already.
The other advantage and reason to have Kate set up a bar is because Batwoman has no equivalent to CC Jitters or that type
yes.
of social environment that, I mean, Supergirl had the alien bar for
some, the alien bar, the donut place across the street. It's also the equivalent of the Big Belly Burger over in Arrow.
Yep.
The social setting.
Yeah.
And there are certain things, it takes a little while to feel your way out of what do we need and why.
Well, and they've been trying to use Kate's office, which is really Bruce Wayne's office, as the social setting. And that's awkward.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fun when the bar gets up and going that Lucius will have to, or Luke, sorry, begin.
Yeah.
Hardcore Batman fan. Luke will be in there not being gay and being a little uncomfortable. You know, how does that play out? There's opportunities for humor.
I think he's going to be helping run the place, which is going to be he's not the only straight guy sitting at the gay bar, but he's going to be kind of behind the bar, but not necessarily
ever behind the bar. I see him as the behind the scenes making the money work. It's like we're losing money on this sort of comments.
Yeah.
He seems to fill a narrative role similar to Curtis.
Yes.
On Arrow.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see the two team up, actually.
Yeah, it would be fun.
So they're doing a good job. There's a couple of things, again, here and there that it doesn't feel like it's in Gotham.
Yeah.
So, and I need them to get a little beyond everything being centered around the massively dysfunctional family dynamic of Kate's extended family.
You know, it's funny. We don't get all that many rooftop scenes. We've had the bat signal, kind of, sort of. But it's kind of some of the trademarks.
That's the part that makes it feel not set in Gotham. The trademark aspects, the bat signal, the Batmobile.
Yes.
The villains, the costumed henchmen. We get bits and pieces of some of this stuff.
They almost need to bat cycle up one for motorcycles.
Absolutely. Well, and ideally do it in a way that it can sort of transform, if you will.
That'd be awesome. Yeah.
You know? At least they've got the equivalent of the grappler and the shoot up to the rooftop sort of a thing, which is, again, a hallmark of the Batman mythos. There's a lot of things that will come with time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not there yet.
Yeah.
This is one where they've had to spend all of their time, rightfully so, setting up the lead hero, the lead villain, the family dynamics, the dysfunction, all of that. And they've moved the needle very far in that regard.
Yeah.
That crisis coming up is going to hit this character by surprise, as it should. It's also a little awkward that almost no time has passed since her last crossover, whereas it's been a busy year for Arrow and Flash and so forth.
Yeah.
So from that respect, the pacing feels off in terms of the show excluding Crisis. The pacing has been good.
Yeah.
So I want to see where they go. I want them to pull in a few more characters. I want to see how this character interacts more with Supergirl and some of the others in the crossover, how that plays out. And I want them to draw a little bit more, if they can, on the classic Batman mythos.
Mm-hmm.
It's always unclear how much can they not do. Oh, maybe they don't want to use Deadshot because he's over in the Suicide Squad movies or something, or
yeah,
or whatever. But you've got like 80 years of Batman comics to pull from, and plenty of tons, but many Batwoman ones to pull from as well. There's a lot to pull in that hasn't already been used over in Arrow or over in, you know, some other show.
I just want to know where Commissioner Gordon is.
At least to comment on that, or Barbara Gordon, or some of these others.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we have not had any mention of Barbara Gordon, Dick Grayson, Tim Drake, Jason Todd, Damian Wayne.
I guess the question is how many of those characters are legally, contractually on the show Gotham. You know what I mean?
Gotham's over, though.
Yeah, true.
But if they were to just go with is this an indeterminate amount of time after Gotham? Is it not, you know?
Yeah.
There's a couple of things they could do to, and I can see where they don't want to be hemmed in by what the Gotham show did.
Yeah.
And I could see where they feel it's been, you know, that show just ended, so to go back to these characters is too soon. That's fine. Again, rich tapestry of material to work from here. You know, pulling Crazy Quilt, Kite Man, some of the lesser ones, and go with that. I'm liking what they're doing. I think they've got a good cast. I think they've got good writing. I think they've got good material. But I also think there's so much more that they could be doing and just haven't done yet.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to how much of a pivot point Crisis will or won't be for this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very curious where we're going to be at the end of the season.
Yeah.
And if they've got a really good long-term plan for this show.
Agreed.
So we'll come back once we've watched the Batwoman episode of Crisis. We'll talk about that. And then we'll come back at the end of the season talking about everything that happened after Crisis. So we're good?
We're good.
Cool. Okay, we've watched Crisis on Infinite Earths Part 2. This was the Batwoman episode. And I felt the story really kind of slowed down a bit this part.
Definitely.
We had a couple of guest stars, and a lot of it was kind of dealing with the aftermath of Ollie's death in the first part.
In the first part, we had these great battles, and this was more of a regrouping.
I didn't feel that the looming threat was really looming as much. I mean, did any worlds die in this?
Well, no, but it was also kind of the night between battles, if you will.
Well, the night between, and also an aspect that thematically ties back to the comic book version, was Lex showing up and turning traitor, essentially. I mean, he's the villain of the piece, historically, not in his mind, grabbing the Book of Destiny and going to kill other Supermans. So getting the world in which the Supergirl, Superman, and Lois are up on the big monitor with Superman having died, to me, that was the pose made iconic with the death of Superman from Doomsday in the comics. So they paid homage to that. Then we get the Lois and Clark from Smallville, Erica Durance and Tom Welling. That Clark, having given up his powers, gets threatened by the Supergirl, Lex Luthor, but decides not to kill him because, well, he's powerless. What's the point? I was a little almost disappointed with that scene. I mean, Tom Welling and Erica Durance did fine.
Well, but there was also something between that scene and when we next see Lex that we don't know about, because he's gone from killing Clark Kent to having Superman kill Superman.
Well, I think it may have been the, you know, killing a Superman who's not Superman. It's what's the point? He could have just been demoralized from that.
Mm.
What got me with that scene, though, in the Smallville universe was Lex gets there and immediately banishes the Superman and or the Clark and Lois he's familiar with, and then makes a comment, Iris, and makes a comment then that, you know, Superman being Clark just doesn't make sense because of the Clark he knows.
Yes.
It's like, did he not notice who he just banished?
Yeah.
And then showing up in the world of the Brandon Routh Superman from Superman Returns, which was a continuation of basically the Christopher Reeve movies.
Mm-hmm.
And even makes a reference, if it's not even the first time I fought myself, kind of thing. So that was nice and well done, I thought. And then having that Superman, which has got the emblem from the Kingdom Come Superman, and just kind of things went a little dark or whatever. So I thought those were some nice, again, pull aspects in from the comics. We then, we're not in any particular order, I'm bouncing around in the order of events here, but we also are, they're searching for these paragons of virtue, of courage, of or hope, courage.
Truth.
And I forget what the others, they named.
Oh, Sarah Lance, we'd already found her, time or something to that
Destiny.
Effect.
Destiny. Yeah. So they knew that Kara was hope, Sarah was Destiny. They were looking for the future bat for courage, and the Kryptonian who's lost more than anyone could bear for truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Brandon Routh Superman. Batwoman turns out being that one. There are three others to go find. I don't recall these paragons having anything to do with the comic book Crisis.
See, to me, that was more, ironically, a callback to the beginning of Legends. There are seven paragons. Well, weren't there originally seven legends that took the seats?
There were seven legends. I think so. But also the following season, there were the six, like Isis's amulet or whatever. So there's the, we got to find the X people.
Yeah, it seemed to be, we've got the seven seats on the ship, so now we have to find the seven paragons. Now that we went and found the time ship, which was a great way to bring in McRory.
True. Well, and I loved having Wentworth Miller do the Leonard AI for this Wave Rider.
Yeah, that was awesome.
That was a nice callback to his character and stuff, and probably an easy way for him to do it. The other thing that makes 7 an interesting number canonically for DC is that's how many members originally there were of the Justice League.
Mm.
And you had a Superman, you had a Batman versus a Batwoman.
They tried for a Batman here.
Yeah. Well, and Kevin Conroy.
Yeah.
Is that Bruce, and almost the Bruce of the Dark Knight era. Great stuff. He did a wonderful job. So that was a lot of fun. But the other 7 in the 7 Justice Leaguers are Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, Flash, Green Lantern, and I think originally it was Martian Manhunter.
Mm.
So going with that number kind of sort of makes sense. Curious who they're going to round it out with.
We didn't really establish where we left the Supergirl cast members that we didn't bring into this episode.
Yes.
We evacuated them to another Earth, and then Kara was still involved in these activities.
I'm not even sure they referenced the armada of fleeing ships at all.
Not at all.
And it should have been, hey, they're landing on Earth, what's going on? So it felt like there were plot lines pushed off to the side from the Supergirl episode.
Mm-hmm.
That was disappointing. The plot line of trying to use a Lazarus pit to resurrect Ollie called back to various Arrow things that have happened over the years.
Yeah, and I mean, that one had pros and cons because they referenced, you know, he'll come out without a soul, but not the bloodlust he would come out with.
Yeah.
And not even a conversation of maybe the bloodlust could be an advantage given the war and the crisis we're going into.
That would have been a very interesting spin.
So
he'll be a little aggressive. That's a good thing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of we don't want a soulless Ollie, but the bloodlust that's always been the major downside to the Lazarus pit, for once we have a productive way to deal with it.
Yeah, what struck me as odd is they'd made reference, I think, in the Supergirl one of, or maybe it was at the beginning of this, of the Legends not wanting to do another crossover.
Yes, this one.
But then we get Constantine out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of characters are almost walking on and out, you know, willy-nilly and stuff. That was a little disconcerting.
Well, the way that line was in there, first of all, it was an awkwardly written line.
Mm-hmm.
I promised the Legends they wouldn't have to do another crossover. It's a breaking of the fourth wall. It's not a play on words.
They've referred to it in their continuity as such, but yes, it is. That show is a little bit more fourth wall, not blatantly breaking, but
tapping up against?
Certainly bumping up against, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think there could have been even if it had just been, I promised Ava, the Legends, and I wouldn't do any more joint missions, we get into enough trouble on our own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something a bit acknowledging Legends wasn't getting its own episode and wasn't a blatant part of the crossover in that sense.
I thought it actually was. I thought they were getting theirs as part 4. I thought their first episode of the season was going to be the fourth part of the Legend stuff. It's Black Lightning that's not got an episode part of it because it's where it shoots.
That's interesting. That makes they didn't want to be in the crossover line even stranger.
But given where we left the Legends, where time had kind of reasserted itself around them, and we had lost, what's her name? It was Isis.
Yes.
To flip out for the brother.
Yes.
I'm not sure how that all plays out.
Well, and with the Legends, it really is always a question of where in time are they?
Yes.
In terms of, are we in their continuity even at that point?
I would have really, granted there's only so much time and stuff, liked to have seen, I think it was Tim Daly as Clark Kent in this episode, because he did the voice for one of the cartoon Supermans.
It would have been a good one.
You know.
He's filming Madam Secretary, so.
Even if they just could have gotten him for a quick scene of they go, not the one kind of a thing. And if you had just seen him, you had seen Adam Baldwin, who did the voice for one of the animated movies. A few things like that.
Yeah.
That would have just been, again, hard to do, but man, it would have been great.
Well, the funny thing is we've gotten used to, in these TV shows, seeing the infamous scene of basically extras holding up mics, cameras, etc., as people rush by with the no comment, no comment. And if you could have had several iterations of Clark Kent all putting the microphone out there of, I just need one good quote for my article.
Well, if you had basically gotten to where they go into one, it's like, they go, it's not the one, you know, you could almost have just had the reaction shot of the different actor as Clark or whatever, and all you need is him in a suit with glasses. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know, at a newspaper-ish sort of a setting, and then you could cut back to different footage of, you know, these people, you know, oh, not him, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So that would have been fun, but again, there's only so much time. It just felt so much like things had slowed down so much.
Mm-hmm.
They have time to go investigate a Lazarus pit or to bemoan this, that, or the other, or to suddenly out of nowhere have this quest for paragons.
Yeah. Well, and then Harbinger starts going crazy, it seems like, when the Book of Destiny appears.
When the Book of Destiny appears, and also as presumably other worlds are getting wiped out and the balance is shifting from matter to antimatter.
Mm.
Weakening the monitor, powering the anti-monitor.
Now, see, if we had occasionally been seeing something up with Leonard AI saying, you know, another X number of worlds were lost.
Even if it wasn't that, and we had just cut to, you know, something of space, you know, Earth, whatever, and then the wave wipes it out.
Yeah.
Something to get that ticking clock going.
Yeah.
That's where I felt they... And some of those scenes would have only taken 10 seconds or something. Now, for one or two of them, you should have... I mean, imagine if they had used the Titan's world for one of those. We see a little bit of something and it gets wiped out or something.
Mm-hmm.
Others, you could have just seen the Earth get obliterated. I get that there's budget, time, logistical constraints. That was one of the things that Marv Wolfman and George Perez did not have to worry about in the comic.
Yeah.
Marv could write anything, George could draw anything. And I mean that in a very literal sense.
Yeah, it's a great combination, especially for a story with this much going on.
Well, George Perez in the comic could literally toss dozens of characters in a one-page splash or a two-page splash or whatever without it feeling crowded, and you could differentiate the different Supermans or different Wonder Womans or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, it's hard to get a shot that has... the two, the Ray Palmer, Adam, the Brandon Routh Superman, and the Supergirl version of Superman kind of all in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the logistics of the filming.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do some of the things that where you can really carefully plan out the panel. It's hard to do that kind of blocking and filming.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious where they're going. They had made mention of another reference beyond just the Book of Destiny, and that was the Book of the Guardians, I think it was?
Yes.
Which goes back to the Green Lantern stuff. And it was, I'm blanking on his name, Krona. That was one of those that had seen what he shouldn't have seen, triggering stuff. We again actually saw the anti-monitor in this episode, seemed to be at Star Labs. Various people seemed to be at Star Labs this time for no explicable reason.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Again, who's where, why, and when? Why did they take the time to get out of costume? Is it really that relaxed? Well, where did they go change?
I think the best example was Kate Kane, Sarah.
And Kara at a bar somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, actually at the bar at...
Star Labs.
Star Labs, yeah.
Yeah, the rec room at Star Labs, basically upstairs. And when Harbinger arrived, I was positive it was that rec room. I was pretty sure. Before that.
But where we had last seen them was at, I thought, Arrow's bunker.
Yeah.
And then they grab a Wave Rider from another world. You know, it's just, they're bouncing all over the place. And when Kate goes to Kara and says, hey, let's go find the Superman or whatever, and she's got the extrapolator or whatever, it took me a little bit to remember, oh yeah, I think they'd given her one last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they referenced that crossover was a year ago.
Yeah.
Between Kara and Kate, yet from Kate's timeline in Batwoman, it sure doesn't feel like a year.
No, it doesn't. No.
So I was puzzled by that. The use of Luke as kind of an Alfred stand-in for the Kevin Conroy Batman scene was interesting.
They were definitely leaning hard in this episode into what a difference a few decisions can make, what difference the Earth you're on can make.
Definitely the situation and the decisions are pivotal and stuff. A little bit of there for the grace of, but for the grace of God kind of a thing I go kind of mentality of, yeah, you didn't go down the bad path, but it wouldn't have been much of a detour.
Mm-hmm.
So I did find that kind of interesting.
Once you slip once, it's easy to slide.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We've seen a little of that last time with Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how paths could have been different. I'm a little surprised that we have not seen different versions of these characters, if you know what I mean.
No.
Another Supergirl, another Batwoman, another this, that, or the other.
Mm-hmm.
We got a little of that with seeing a photo of Kate and Beth.
Yeah.
From the Batwoman stuff.
But this was very much a Clark Kent-centric episode in that sense.
Yes. Yes. But even then, it would have been nice to have had Dean Cain. It would have...
Mm-hmm.
I did not feel where Smallville left off and where this picked up made sense. And I know they had coordinated with the people who'd done Smallville. As a matter of fact, I think some of them may have been involved in the writing. But him leaving off as being Superman, him coming here as he's just Clark, gave that up a while ago.
Yeah.
Reference to Lex being president. Okay, we'd seen the flash forward type stuff. Got it. But it just... Why that Clark would have given up the powers and stuff, I have no idea.
They didn't give a reason, but to me, they were trying to differentiate from our Clark, who felt he could have the powers and be a father in this moment, but back on Argo City, had been wanting to be powerless and a father.
I took some of the Argo City stuff as just a logistical practicality. You don't want to raise a Kryptonian baby with a human mother at that age. It superpowers and could kill the mother. But that Superman's, can I have it all? And the answer being from this Clark of, well, no.
Yeah.
And then who picked up his slack? Who is the hero of this world?
Yeah.
I mean, there are others. If he'd mentioned, hey, you know, Ollie and these other people, they had it covered. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the case. I mean, and I had thought that in Smallville, the farm had been sold and stuff like that. I don't remember. It's not a big deal. It's not a problem. But I'd have to rewatch where that show left off because it didn't feel like this was kind of that 10 years later.
Yeah, I can see that.
But so far, we've had people doing multiple roles. Stephen Amell,
mm-hmm.
two different Olivers. Erica Durance.
Yeah, Kara's mother and Lois.
And then Brandon Routh.
Yes.
And Lamont Garrett or whatever doing Monitor, Anti-Monitor.
Yes.
Have we had any others?
We've had the Luke Fox doing geeky, normal Luke Fox and then buffed up.
Do we actually see the other Luke Fox in the crossover? We saw somebody Fair from the point. Batwoman stuff doing a different character.
Fair point. Okay. I'll give you that. Yeah.
So, again, doesn't matter, but...
I was more intrigued by how many people... actors played Clark Kent and was thinking, you know, when they wrote the script, they almost had to write Clark Kent parentheses Smallville. Clark Kent parentheses Brandon Routh. I mean,
certainly when they wrote the script, the final version and stuff, when they were asking people, could you do it? It's a, we've got an idea for this sort of a thing. We'll customize it based on.
Yeah.
And I've got to wonder if some of what happened in some of these scenes went a little longer than it would have if they'd been able to get Michael Rosenbaum for that Lex, or they'd been able to get Dean Cain, or they'd been able to get somebody else.
Yeah.
And again, logistical issues. There's certain things that, you know, it's like, we're going to film at this point because that's where the episode lands. And I get it. But that's, again, one of the big differences between, say, writing a novel or writing a comic book versus a movie or certainly a TV show. There's just scheduling issues.
Yeah.
Whereas Marv Wolfman could have put anybody he wanted wherever he wanted in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
This one, while it had thematic similarities to the comic, I'd be hard-pressed to name any particular scene that I thought had a directly corresponding scene in the comics other than what happened with Harbinger.
Mm. Oh, we didn't see the Pariah.
No, didn't see Pariah at all.
which goes into kind of nothing earth-shattering happening. But what made me think of it was I was sitting here wondering, basically, if you don't watch all of the shows, if you only watched a few episodes of the crossover, could you follow the storyline without seeing every single episode? And I'm thinking if you missed this episode, you might be okay.
Well, let's see. If you skipped Supergirl and got into the second chapter here, you'd be wondering what's going on. They kind of sort of recap, but you'd be lost, and I think you would have missed the better part. If you watched the first part and not this, you missed the introduction of the Anti-Monitor. You missed the whole bit of the Paragons, both of which are things they're going to recap. I think they have to in the next part, but we'll see when we get to Flash. This one felt, I don't want to say like filler, but a little more extraneous than certainly the first part.
Yeah, the first part felt critical in part because it was establishing the situation.
Exactly.
Which is always feels critical.
But that's the problem with doing an epic event, and particularly one that's crossing between different things versus in a comic, Crisis was its own storyline, its own title that tied into other issues. Those other issues were more like these, where the balancing act is almost impossible.
Mm.
It's got to be tangential enough that people don't feel they must read all 50,000 parts of this versus the 12-issue series or whatever. Because literally, there were dozens of crossover issues for Crisis. And that's not uncommon for a line-wide event. So it can't be so tangential that it's crippling if you don't read it. Yet, it can't be so much of a side story that it's like, well, why did I read this?
Yeah.
But it's got to be important enough to add something, but something missable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, man, it's like threading a needle. How do you do that?
I mean, they gave some good character moments. They gave some stuff worth watching. Just nothing that felt critical to the Crisis experience.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious how the next one picks up on what they did here and if the next episode makes it feel like there was more in here than I was recognizing at the time. If the Paragons were more important than I realized or anything of that sort.
I think they're going to be very important. I just don't know in what way. And we only know 4 of the 7.
True. But I mean, we saw Kara have what amounts to a crisis of faith. In her case, a crisis of hope.
Yeah.
For instance. You know, Kate doesn't seem to recognize that she was, in her own way, facing a test and discovering just how courageous she truly was.
Mm-hmm. But both of those personifications fit those characters.
Yes.
So I appreciated those aspects.
Yeah.
The whole bit with Destiny kind of made sense, particularly in light of Sarah's conversation with the other Ollie.
Mm-hmm.
And her kind of convoluted history.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure I would have pegged her as a definitely fate-driven kind of a character.
No.
Destiny-driven or whatever. Yeah. I'm not sure who I would in this universe.
That's part of my problem.
So, I'm curious what the other kind of personifications of Paragons are going to be.
Me too.
I'm expecting, frankly, a big cliffhanger at the end of Flash.
Okay.
Because then we're going to have kind of the holidays before we get the two parts, which I think may air back-to-back in January.
Hmm.
So depending how long these three parts go, I may do these as 2 episodes or whatever. We've still got to watch the next part on Flash. So overall, I'm liking it. I didn't feel this was as epic as the first.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the crossover or tie-ins or other actors and stuff were nice. I think it was great to see Kevin Conroy finally be able to actually physically play Batman. And man, you know, the voice, he of course nailed it.
Yeah.
And he did such a terrific job on Batman the Animated Series that allowing him to kind of come in and do this version of Batman live action, I thought was just terrific.
Yeah, it was very cool.
You know, as good of a job as Tom Welling did, it's hard for me not to think that Clark went the way he did because Tom Welling did not want to wear the suit.
There could be some of that.
It would have been nice to have seen, again, a couple of more crossovers here or there. And man, I would have loved to have seen, and who knows, possibly still could, you know, Linda Carter as, you know, some version of Wonder Woman, as some kind of paragon of something or other.
Yeah.
So we'll see where they go. It was good. It was fun. But I think this was a lesser part than the first part.
I agree.
All right. We'll move on to the next part. So we have finished watching up through episode 20 of the first season. I say it that way versus through the end of the first season because COVID, pandemic, they ended where they ended.
It's a very interesting time in TV in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In terms of shows typically finished the episode they were in the process of filming, if they could, if they were close enough, if they were mm-hmm. over halfway through filming and could. But shows are also now going to have to decide. They already had the following scripts written. Do they film them as written? Or when they come back, because they were hoping to just stop production for 2 weeks and then come back.
They had a plan for another 2 episodes. This worked as acceptably as a finale for a season. Not great, but not bad. There was.
It's funny because, unfortunately, the final episode aired 3 days before we watched it.
At least. We're watching it on, actually, Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah. And the unfortunate result
or
is...
Or did it air the previous week?
No.
Okay, Just 3 days.
Yeah, but a lot of articles came out in those 3 days. And so we know things that we wouldn't have known if we had watched it and recorded it the night it aired.
Absolutely. This is going to be a slightly different discussion based on that. Because, I mean, we'd watched and recorded up through Crisis. We came back to this and have watched it pretty much as it was coming out, mm-hmm. Give or take a couple of days or a week or two here and there in pandemic backlog, of course. They changed a couple of things with Crisis,
mm-hmm.
Bringing Beth back and then killing Beth back off.
I liked bringing Beth back.
I was surprised how quickly they killed her off.
So was I. I was disappointed by that. And going back to the things we know now, if they had known at that point how casting things were going to play out, I can't help but wonder if they would have tried to keep Beth and have it evolve into Beth as Batwoman.
I don't think so. When I found out that Ruby Rose was not going to continue on to a second season, they were going to recast. Or when I found out she wasn't going to continue, before I found out they were going to recast, my first thought was they could either take Sophie or more likely Julia Pennyworth and have her become Batwoman.
Yeah.
Which would be a departure from the comics, but it's not like they haven't departed from the comics before.
Well, the unfortunate thing with the way the season ended and with the knowledge we have is they've almost set the show up to spin on a dime and become Batman.
I don't think so. I think where they ended with Tommy Elliot having Batman in Bruce Wayne's face, I don't see them as setting him up to be Batman in any way, shape, or form.
I don't think they meant to.
To me, they're doing their version of Hush, which was a 12-issue story in Batman by Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee. And they've actually got an animated version out that I've got sitting over here that we may watch at some point. And they're not hitting all the story points and stuff, but they've used Hush through the end of the season and such. And where they went with him... To me, they were swapping him out as a replacement for Mouse.
I think they felt they'd run their course with Mouse. I'm not saying I disagree. I'm saying I think that's where they were coming from.
It's funny because I think they could have gone the Bruce Wayne route with Mouse.
Yes.
And actually, it would have been funny if they had done that and then in a second season at the end of it, done this with Tommy.
Mm.
To where it's he keeps coming back and it's not him. And then at one point he comes back and nobody believes it's him.
Yes.
I mean, there's some fun stuff they could do there.
Well, just from a basic, okay, we've watched the first season, how do I feel about it point of view, I don't feel it was Kate Kane's or Batwoman's story. I feel it was Alice's story.
I think they focused a lot on Alice, more so than, Kate, because she becomes Batwoman, she grows a little, but she's nowhere near the interesting character that Alice is. And I've been fearing throughout as the season progressed that Alice was going to be the equivalent of Tobias over in Black Lightning that we just can't get rid of.
Yeah.
And while his situation over there changes, so does Alice's a little bit here. She'd been hanging with the Mouse. Next season, presumably, it'll be Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping to get more development with Batwoman and to branch out a little bit more into kind of the rest of Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many characters. I mean, we're a season in, roughly. We'll say a full season. I mean, obviously, there's 2 episodes, but it is what it was. We don't even know really who the commissioner is.
Well, and that's one of the things that first leap to mind. When I think Batman, I think the relationship with Commissioner Gordon. I mean, who the heck was turning on the bat signal?
We don't know who the commissioner is. We know Bruce is gone. We don't know what happened to Alfred or any of the other characters. Is there a Batgirl, a Robin, a Nightwing, a Red Hood, all those sorts of things. None of the regular villains have shown up.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Gotham at the beginning was this crime-infested, you had to be in an armored car to go to a party, and it's not that way here at the end.
Well, and we aren't really dealing with criminals each episode in terms of, I'm hard-pressed to say, who did Batwoman take down? I mean, she took down 4 or 5 people over 20 episodes.
Well, without Alice, how bad is the crime rate in Gotham, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been nice if... And you can chalk some of this up to Crisis, Different World, whatever, although they didn't really play it that way. But there's not the sense that Batwoman has stopped the street-level crime that was just happening all over the place and made any real difference with that.
Yeah.
And I think one of the problems with more modern-day comic book story versus, you know, decades back is there's more almost gang warfare infighting stories of the revenge match. You've got the archenemy of Alice and everything centers around that, or Tobias, or, you know, whomever.
Mm-hmm.
Versus back in the day, you know, the average superhero would stop a bank robbery of just thugs robbing the bank.
Yeah.
It wasn't part of some big master plan of somebody's.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's something that's changed over the decades and is just how it is now. We've gotten enough people looped into who Batwoman is between Sophia, Julia, obviously Luke, Mary.
Does Sophia truly know or suspect?
You're right. She suspects. She does not know. She knows Batwoman is interested in her. She has not put 2 to 2 together that Batwoman is Kate. You are correct. But she's kind of on the fringe of the inner circle.
Yeah.
She had to have Julia warn Batwoman versus do it herself. So that's a fair point. But we haven't built up any real in-suit allies of Batwoman yet, nor do I see anyone on that trajectory.
Yeah. But I think Mary is great.
I think they're doing a great job with her, absolutely. I think there's more they could do with Luke.
Yes.
In the comics, in addition to helping out some with Batwoman or Batman's tech, he was Batwing.
Mm.
The second, actually, not the first. So he has a suited identity he could easily take on. But in this last episode, when Batwoman had, you know, broken ribs or whatever, and she goes out and fights as if she's perfectly well, they had no other choice. They didn't have a Diggle. They didn't have somebody else they could swap in.
Well, and I was wishing that there'd been a line or two about, look, the suit may reinforce you and act like a rib cage, etc., but there are limits.
Yeah. Or if somebody had said, you know, you need to have, you know, something support the thing, and well, the Batsuit can do that. It's not meant to.
Yeah.
But it's not like Bruce didn't use it that way a lot. I mean, there's ways they could have done that, or, and it would have been a great point for Luke to have mentioned, yes, I refitted the suit, but not every aspect of it. So there's aspects where, again, with any kind of action adventure, you know, you just shake off the wounds.
I gotta say, I was annoyed, and I compare it to both their mother's names were Martha. Kryptonite was the one thing the suit can't handle.
I was annoyed by that because it's like, okay, Superman's weakness is now Batwoman's weakness. And when they explained that it was just this really impervious metal, there's some logic to that in so much as, well, it's from Superman's home world. It would be as strong or whatever, although you can apparently crush it with an earthbound, you know, pile driver, whatever the hell it was they used. I think that was a bad move.
I didn't like it, especially since we saw Batman on Earth 99 or whatever with the kryptonite in the wrist gauntlet.
Yeah, powered by it. If they had basically played up over the course of the season that this suit is just unbreakable. And she's like, how? I don't get it. There's no metal on Earth that's this way, kind of, you know, and, mm-hmm. and Luke's just, I can't tell you, you know, kind of a thing. But the implication is that it's either made of kryptonite, which it doesn't seem to be the case, or it's the strongest thing on Earth, yet kryptonite is stronger because it's Kryptonian. There's some things there they could have set up better.
Yeah.
Versus when it comes out in the journal, oh, it's kryptonite. I'm like, where the hell did that come from? And it was convenient because she happened to have some.
Yeah.
So now if they had done it such that it wound up being a crossover and we saw Alice in Supergirl for an episode.
Yes.
I might have been more forgiving.
Yes.
You know, there's some ways they could have made that work.
Yeah, Alice seemed oblivious to Supergirl and Superman in that whole conversation.
Well, there was no mention, for the most part, of any real ramifications of being on the same world as everybody else now. No mention of what's going on in Freeland. There was one or two mentions here or there. I forget what they were.
We had the interview by Kara of Batwoman in the Catco magazine.
We had that, and there was some comment that happened at the Crow's office that mentioned something external. I forget if it was Argus or something of the sort. Maybe it was Argus. But it didn't seem like this show really grew any way after Crisis. I mean, they changed up one or two things, but even really the one or two that they did of bringing Beth back, which they never really explained.
Yeah.
They got rid of that within, what, two, three episodes?
I think it was all in one. I think in the same episode we discovered she was back, she was gone. It might have been two, but
I thought it was in the second that she died at the end, and then the third was kind of the ramifications of that.
Oh, that could be. Okay. Yeah, because we did have the go to the morgue.
Yeah, because it took at least an episode or two to even find out she was definitely back.
Okay.
I thought it was a missed opportunity, and in a way, a little bit of a poor execution of kind of what they'd done with Brainiac over in Supergirl. With him having kind of the different manifestations.
Well, to me, it was just we want to give you a glimpse of what Beth could have been.
Yeah, and I like that. But it would have been nice if she'd been around for a few episodes as Alice is just laying low. And people are, well, is she really Beth? Maybe she's, you know.
Yeah.
Play that up a little bit more. They believe her. There's the false, you know, who's who kind of a thing. I mean, there was a lot of story potential there that they just kind of glossed right past.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure. I mean, obviously next season they're going to be dealing with Tommy as Bruce for a little bit as spillover from the rest of this season.
Yes.
What would have been the ending of that, the kryptonite stuff, whatever. So I'm expecting a two-episode opener of next season that would have been the finale here. Maybe they'll extend it a little, whatever. But after that, I'm not sure where they're going to go or where they should go. And then that's all also complicated by, you know, swapping out the lead actress. And I thought Ruby Rose did a good job.
She did. I mean, the more I looked into it, and I had known about the uproar when she was cast. And it reminds me of the conversation we've had where, like, Daniel Day Kim was saying he was the wrong Asian.
There was a panel about what it's like to be an Asian actor. I forget where it was. I saw it on YouTube. And maybe it wasn't just Asian. It was how to, you know, kind of color or whatever the proper terminology is. And he was saying that basically it's not just, you know, are you Asian, but are you the right type?
Yeah.
Korean versus Vietnamese versus Japanese versus Chinese versus whatever. And it's unfortunate when you've got really good actors like him and various others that get kind of pigeonholed that way. But I also kind of think there's a, I don't say a double standard, but there's a really crazy way that our society or our planet views this through. Because if you cast a non-Asian in a classically Asian role, oh, that's just wrong.
Yeah.
However, if you want to take, you know, Lana Lang, a redhead, you know, white girl in Smallville and cast her with Kirsten Crook or whatever, who did a fantastic job, that's great. And again, can't see that role any other way. She did great with it. Or the way they recast Jimmy in Supergirl or various other things. I think there's an aspect of a lot of these classic, particularly with DC comic characters, originated back in the 30s, 1930s.
Yeah.
Got to clarify that because this could still be around on the podcast feed, you know, in the 2030s.
Yeah.
Everybody was white. It was all that way. And we need a better representation. I totally agree with the diversity aspect and stuff like that. But I do think there's an aspect where if you take an existing character and quote unquote correct it to be more diverse, that I start to have some issues with versus just create a new character, make it organic.
Well, but the other thing, going to your point of a good actor should get the role. One of the TV shows I loved in the 80s, Father Dowling, Catholic priest, goes and solves mysteries, played by Tom Bosley. Saw an interview with him, must have been like a decade after that. Do you know what he said surprised most people when they talked to him about that role?
To find out he's Jewish?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and he said he had no problems as a Jew doing all the Catholic aspects of that role because he had been fascinated by a character who went and solved crimes, and his concern was not putting someone in a prison cell. His concern was justice. What's best for the souls of those involved? He said to him it wasn't decidedly Catholic. It was something people of every faith could relate to. It happened to be a Catholic character.
But it could have just as easily been a Jewish rabbi or something else.
Yes, but he didn't want to see the original work changed from what it was.
And that I respect. And there's an aspect where if you're going to take a character like Batwoman, who's a lesbian, do you have to have, should you have, a lesbian actress? Don't know. I'm not going to weigh in on that. I really kind of don't care either way if you've got a good actress. And they found a great one here.
Yes.
Not working out, apparently, on both sides to the point they decided to mutually part ways. I think that puts whoever takes over the role in a very interesting position of being compared to.
Yes. Well, and apparently Ruby Rose was faulted for not being lesbian enough, which I find an interesting phrase.
Yeah.
For not being Jewish, because technically Kate Kane is Jewish. Not that we saw a lot of menorahs, not that we saw a lot of Jewish scenes, if you will.
I have read maybe not every comic that version of Batwoman has been in. I mean, I may have missed a ironically enough, a Christmas special or two. I would be hard pressed to name any major storyline where the religion of the character came into play. That having been said, not recalling the various Christmas specials I have read where they have usually, for lack of a better term, the token Jewish story. You know, and they've gotten to where it's a holiday special, not a Christmas special sometimes, whatever. And I get it.
I mean,
in terms of, you know, representation and stuff like that, but they're acting. It's like, it's like the Saturday Night Live skit that Christopher Reeve did, auditioning for Superman. And, you know, they shoot him, can he catch the bullet, you know, that kind of a thing, as if he had to have the superpowers to get the role.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think of from the season that was specifically notably Jewish was the bat mitzvah. And we didn't go inside. We were leaving it.
Yeah. No, and they did establish, you're right, the character was Jewish in that respect. And I like when fictional characters have a faith. And it's relevant to them, whether they're devout, always going, you know, or it's just an occasional thing. And I like to see that of different faiths and so forth. Again, for that representation, it's something that I think is important because people of every faith need to have a heroic fictional character they can relate to.
But see, I see it as more than that. Not only should everyone have someone they can relate to, when all the faiths are represented, we can learn about other faiths.
Absolutely. That was the other thing I was going to bring up, is it opens other people's minds.
Yeah.
And they can learn more about it. I learned a lot about, you know, the Muslim faith and whatnot. Not tons, but at least that slice of life by reading Ms. Marvel, you know, where that character was in, you know, that community and stuff that I didn't know the terms for. How did they refer to, you know, a mother, a father, you know, the different colloquialisms and so forth. And it was interesting. So I do think that's good, but at what point is it forced into a story or restricting casting choices or something like that? And there's no clear line or good answer on any of that.
I'm just trying to figure out how a Christian could be looked at and not play a Jew convincingly in terms of, like, we used to live near an Orthodox synagogue. And yes, you could tell by looking which men were members of the Orthodox synagogue. So in that respect, I can see where somebody would say, if a Christian man is not willing to go to the effort to have but the beard, etc., and look like an Orthodox Jew.
I could see a case where you could have a non-Jew play the Orthodox, look it, do the whatever the ritualistic aspects are, mm-hmm. and just nail it because they're a serious actor who takes the time, does the research, versus somebody who is Jewish, mm-hmm. but, you know, just isn't, I don't want to say isn't that Jewish, but isn't that into the religion.
Well, I was talking with a fellow Christian the other night, and I shared something about their own faith that they didn't know that's a part of American history, simply because it was something I happened to know.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that you have to be of a religion to know the religion or to be able to portray it strikes me as odd.
Yeah.
To me, it's more a matter of research, diligence, and effort.
Well, and if you're gonna, not if, since they have to recast Batwoman, finding the best actress for the role. It's a very mm-hmm. physical role.
Yes.
And there's certain aspects that you just can't act that way. You kind of, again, Stephen Amell doing the salmon ladder, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was in shape. So was the guy who played Diggle. I mean, there's a
yeah.
ton. I don't expect Grant Gustin to run a 4-minute mile.
Really? No.
That you can fake.
Yeah.
But so there's some wiggle room on some of that stuff. But you've got to have somebody who looks like she could be, you know, the fighter out of the suit that Batwoman is. I think there's an aspect of how different can the replacement actress look from Ruby Rose. There's some ways you can kind of do the wavy hands and just ignore it. This isn't the first time that a lead character for a DC live action show has been replaced after the first season.
Which show are you thinking of?
I am thinking of Adventures of Superboy.
Ah.
Where it was John Haynes Newton for the first season, and then Christopher Gerald, one of the
yeah.
two.
Yeah, yeah, that was a million years ago, last century.
Yeah, it was ages ago.
Yeah.
And they both looked like they could have been Superboy, but they looked, I mean, you're not going to confuse the two, you know,
mm-hmm.
side by side. So there's some wiggle room, but I do think that finding the right actress is going to be challenging, because I'm certainly going to compare to Ruby Rose.
Yeah.
She originated the role. She's doing a great job, you know? So mm-hmm. I think figuring out a way to do that between seasons is the best point. At this point, given the abrupt ending of the season, it makes it a little more challenging.
Yeah.
But maybe the first episode of the next season is just going to start with us seeing more of Batwoman in costume, and it's not until the end that we get the unveiling or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some ways they could do that. And it comes down to, can they capture what was working about the character, the relationships with Luke, Mary, all that kind of stuff, and go forward with that?
Well, I think the other thing for any actress taking on the part is they're going to have to look at Ruby Rose's performance and figure out what were the defining aspects that the fans are going to need to have a new performance resonate.
The person they need to have talk with whoever takes the role is Michael Shanks.
Mm, yes.
Michael Shanks played Daniel Jackson in Stargate SG-1.
Mm-hmm.
And he had taken over the role from the movie where it was played by James Spader.
Yeah.
And it was coming into SG-1 smooth.
Yeah.
He had the mannerisms. He had enough that it's like it felt like the same character. Over the course of 8 or 10 years of Stargate SG-1, the character changed, became different, grew.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to do a slow, you know, evolution of the character.
Yeah.
To where at the beginning of second season, it needs to be like the Ruby Rose Batwoman. By the end of the second season, you've had the time to slowly change it into what does this actress, you know,
yeah,
feel Batwoman should be.
The other example, though, is Spartacus,
mm-hmm.
where in the beginning it was one actor, and then when he was diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
He helped the show find a replacement for him.
So there's ways they can smooth yeah. that over. But the irony is, since so much of this is more Alice's story than Batwoman's story,
yeah,
she'd have been the harder one to replace.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I say that, but then immediately I think because of the over-the-top, almost caricaturish aspect at times of Alice, I think you could have dropped in Amy Acker or a couple of other actresses.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And with the right makeup and stuff, I think you could do it.
Yeah.
Because we were watching one of these episodes, and it just dawned on me, Alice's voice is Amy Acker.
Yeah.
The presentation, the diction, the enunciation, the stresses and stuff, it just felt like the various roles she's played over the years.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm hoping they can make a smooth transition.
I'm hoping next season the Commander is a bit more nuanced.
Yeah, I didn't like the direction they were going with him. I'm hoping they can find a way to evolve the show to where it's not Batwoman kind of versus the Crows mm-hmm. and whoever else is the big bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they can branch out a little bit more.
Yeah.
And we've seen other shows do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've gotten away from spending all of Supergirl's time over at CatGo or the DEO and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Took a few seasons. We haven't gotten to that point with Black Lightning, though.
No.
So we'll see where they go. I'm wanting more Batman family characters, both heroes and villains, showing up.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to see Dick Grayson Nightwing show up.
That'd be nice.
You know, at least establish how far did Batman get on all of that. There's no sign of the Robins or anything of the sort in the Batcave.
Mm-mm.
But this is also the Batcave under Wayne Tower, which presumably may not be the primary Batcave.
Mm-hmm.
But to not even get a mention of Alfred and a few of those other things, it feels a bit odd.
Yeah.
And the other question is, are they going to try to, I don't say grandfather in Gotham?
Mm-hmm.
The mention of Commissioner Loeb, whom I thought was the original one in Gotham, makes me wonder. I'm wondering if that was the one Peter Scolari played. I don't remember. We got a season into Gotham, a few episodes into the second season, and just haven't gone back yet.
Yeah.
At some point, we will. But other shows are higher on the list.
Yeah.
Overall, I like this. It was a little too one-tracked on the whole Alice thing.
I want them to pay more attention to the continuity on Mary.
Yeah.
Is the clinic open? Is the clinic closing? Does she have staff?
Yeah, because we can go episodes without even mentioning the clinic.
Yeah. Just some consistency.
Yeah. There's room for improvement there. It's a good show. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's dark.
Yes.
It's violent.
Mm-hmm.
Between Mouse, the whole face stitching stuff.
Yeah.
Hush. It got a little gross in places.
Yeah.
So didn't care for that. But it shows some promise. I think if they can make the transition smoothly to a replacement actress for Batwoman and kind of reflect on what worked and what didn't work on the first season, they could come out with a strong second season.
And oddly, the pandemic will help them. They're not returning in September or October. They're returning in January.
Yes. That gives them a lot more time to recast and retool.
Yeah.
And I don't think they need massive retooling. But some time to sit and reflect, I think, will do them some good.
Yeah. And I found it interesting that some of the city shots are Chicago, but they are filming in Vancouver.
It makes sense. I think they've used Chicago enough for the movies and stuff like that. That's what people kind of expect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fine with that. Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.